ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Pauline Hanson banned from the Senate for 7 sitting days after yesterday's burqa stunt. Also, the White House orders its embassy in Canberra to gather data on crime committed by migrants in Australia. And it was Crocodile Dundee's favourite watering hole. Now the Walkabout Creek pub has a new owner.
I think the scene where the American reporter takes in the outside of the pub and then goes in and meets the locals really demonstrates the power of filmmaking.
First this evening, the Insurance Council of Australia has declared yesterday's supercell hailstorms in southeast Queensland a catastrophe. The huge band of storms moved from northern New South Wales up to central Queensland late in the day, damaging homes and downing huge trees. Winds of more than 100 kilometres an hour and 14 centimetre hailstones were recorded during the storms. 70,000 homes remain without power this evening, as the region once again braces for more wild weather. Rachel Mealy reports.
As Justin Petersey walked home from school yesterday on Bribie Island, north of Brisbane, he noticed the sky go dark.
Actually, I was walking home, I looked behind me, there's a big cloud. I was like, surely it doesn't get to me before I get home. And it didn't. But then a few minutes later, all hell broke loose. It was really bad.
A few streets away, Tony Teresi was in his car trying to get home as the wind raged.
It was terrifying. I'll be honest, yeah, I don't get scared often, but yeah, that scared me, I must admit.
He says he was swerving as he drove to avoid falling trees.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to explain. It was just literally two storms merging together, and as I tried to make my way back home to Sandstone Point, it just went nuts, and trying to get up through Warram, and trees were falling down everywhere, and trying to drive side to side of the road, trying to dodge the branches coming down, and had to pull into the tyre shop for some refuge, and then got stuck further up the road with the wires and the telephone poles snapped from the wind.
The Insurance Council of Australia has declared the storm a catastrophe, with 16,000 claims already lodged across 140 postcodes. Giant hailstones up to 14 centimetres wide, destructive winds, and more than 500,000 lightning strikes were recorded across the southeast corner of Queensland as the storm band pummeled the region. At Bribie Island, trees were uprooted, roofs ripped off, and power lines felled. Robin Pierce says she can't remember a storm as fierce.
Well, we saw it coming, and got heads up from kids down in Brisbane Way, said that's heading your way, so we sort of watched it and thought, oh no, it'd fizzle out. Usually it does, but no, it just came with a vengeance and it was so quick and fast. And we lost power at about, 5 o'clock, and still no power. No power, no internet, no nothing.
Today she walked around her neighbourhood to survey the damage.
Lots of trees down everywhere, power lines down, roads closed, there's trees on houses, on cars, just, yeah.
Danny Donald is from power supplier Energex.
It's southeast Queensland. We get belted every single year, as it seems now, and worse and worse. So we're just, it's just a case now of remaining patient, and we will be there.
Shane Kennedy is a senior forecaster at the Weather Bureau.
For this season, since July, we've had 10 days with giant hail on a severe thunderstorm forecast. And that's comparable to this point. On average, we typically have around 4 days. So it's well above the average there. And also quite active compared to last year, whereas to this point in late November, we had 7 days with giant hail on our forecast. So we have seen an unusual number of days with giant hail this season.
He says there's more rough weather on the horizon for southeast Queensland.
We may once again see severe thunderstorms across southeastern Queensland. Expecting it to be a bit later than Monday, but we could have those thunderstorms move through later in today, late evening, but also overnight into the early morning of Wednesday.
That's senior forecaster Shane Kennedy, that report from Rachel Mealy. One Nation Senator Pauline Hanson has been banned from the Senate for 7 sitting days after she entered the chamber yesterday wearing a burqa, the garment worn by some Muslim women to cover their head and body. A censure motion saying her behaviour was intended to vilify and mock people on the basis of religion was passed by Labor, the Greens and one Liberal. It's believed no parliamentarian has been suspended for as long a period of time as 7 sitting days since the 1970s. Senator Hanson says she took the action to protest the Senate's refusal to allow debate on her bill to ban face coverings. She was unrepentant today and said she doesn't have any respect for most of her colleagues in Parliament.
I'm censured. Does it really worry me? No, it doesn't. For 7 days? Not at all. I stand my ground and what I believe in. I will continue to do so. It will be the people that will judge me. I will be standing for the next election in Queensland, and I will let the people of Queensland judge me whether I have earned my place to be re-elected again or not. I will not let these people here judge me.
Associate Professor Paul Williams is a political commentator at Griffith Uni in Brisbane. He told me Pauline Hanson deserves to be suspended from the Senate for 7 sitting days.
Partly because of it clearly does breach Senate rules, but it also is because it sends a message, I think, to the party and to Pauline Hanson that I think she's overstepped the mark this time. And I think the community would be on board this time. There might have been, she certainly attracted a degree of agreement and support in 2017 when she last wore a burqa in the Senate. And my hypothesis then is that she was flagging in the polls and there was a discernible lift in the polls, and she had a spring in her step after she did it. She was more or less becoming a bit irrelevant in 2017. She wore the burqa and it made her relevant again. Recent opinion polls have showed that she's peaking at about 18%. Federally in some polls across Australia, and about the same in Queensland at state level. So there's a huge spike in One Nation support, and it seems very opportunistic that Pauline Hanson would do this now.
So isn't that likely to appeal to many in her base then?
Well, it would only, to my understanding, it would only consolidate the support that she's got. Yes, there are people in the community who would absolutely love what Pauline Hanson did yesterday, but it's not going to bring any more on board. And it might actually chip away at some of the supporters that she's accrued in recent months. We know that a lot of the hard right of the coalition supporters have moved to Pauline Hanson because they've been aggrieved at what looks like soft peddling on climate change, and they've been aggrieved at what they see in Susan Lee as a moderate Liberal leader. And so it's no doubt there's a lot of the hard right, especially among men and especially among regional Australia, have gone back to One Nation and protest, as it were, at what they see as a soft coalition. And more importantly, it does open a door ideologically and in the public and electoral narrative for moderates like Susan Lee to prosecute a case that the coalition should not be flirting with the populism of One Nation and some of its more extreme ideology.
Senator Hanson was asked by a reporter today why she hadn't spoken out against neo-Nazis wearing balaclavas at recent rallies, and she said that her call for a ban on face coverings doesn't just relate to burqas, but all face coverings, including balaclavas, as a matter of national security. What do you make of that response?
Yeah, well, it sounds like that Ms. Hanson had to be prompted for that sort of response. She was remarkably silent on the neo-Nazis gathering on the steps of the New South Wales Parliament recently, and I don't think it passes the pub test.
Paul Williams, we know Senator Hanson had dinner with Barnaby Joyce last night after her burqa stunt. She said today that she, quote, wined and dined him with a good steak. How likely is it, do you think, that Barnaby Joyce will leave the Nationals and join One Nation?
Well, it seemed like a sure bet a few weeks ago, and then he seemed to be lukewarm on it. We know that Senator Hanson's very keen to get him on board because he would bring an enormous amount of legitimacy to her party and to her movement. You know, it's one thing for a sitting MP to go across. It's another thing for a former party leader to go across. I mean, remember when Cheryl Kernow moved to Labor, that was an enormous deal in the 1990s. And so for a former leader like Barnaby Joyce to go across would offer her enormous legitimacy and quite possibly, you know, see her win lower house seats. And they're already on the cusp of winning lower house seats the next federal election. It seems that Mr. Joyce is still lukewarm. He knows that that's a bridge. Once he's crossed it, he can't come back. And it would threaten his entire legacy as a member of parliament and previously as a senator.
Associate Professor Paul Williams from Griffith Uni in Brisbane. The Trump administration has instructed the US Embassy in Canberra to gather data on crimes committed by migrants in Australia. The directive was apparently sent to several other Western nations too. Observers here say the move doesn't pose a risk to Australia's sovereignty, but is another significant development in US immigration policy. Julia Bergen prepared this report.
When politicians talk about immigration reform, they usually mean the following: amnesty, open borders, lower wages.
Immigration has always been at the heart of Donald Trump's presidential pitch. He's made it clear. He wants it wound right back.
Immigration reform should mean something else entirely. It should mean improvements to our laws and policies to make life better for American citizens.
And now the president's anti-immigration agenda is going global. The White House has issued a directive to United States embassy staff around the world, ordering them to gather data on the, quote, crimes and human rights abuses committed by people of a migration background. Posting on X earlier this week, the Department of State said it wanted to help Western nations solve what it described as a global crisis.
Mass migration poses an existential threat to Western civilization and undermines the stability of key American allies. Today, the State Department instructed US embassies to report on the human rights implications and public safety impacts of mass migration.
That instruction went to US embassy staff in Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Western nations across Europe. Reports in Nine newspapers today quote a senior State Department official as saying the administration wants to warn its friends about the perils of migration. That means things like political unrest and economic instability. But Greens Senator David Shoebridge says this is no friendly gesture by the Trump administration.
This is a really dangerous export of the Trump administration's right-wing anti-migrant policies. And previously, at least there was some restraint from the United States about openly interfering with their allies' domestic policies. But the US is not even pretending to hide this anymore.
Senator Shoebridge says the US is trying to manipulate other countries' policies on race and migration, including Australia.
The US vice president has said that he wants to use US power, US trade power, US diplomatic power, US economic power to lecture and force the United States allies to change their immigration policies, change other domestic policies. You know, there's a clear pattern here. This isn't just gathering information for curiosity's sake. This is to weaponize the information against the United States' own allies.
In a written statement, the federal government says it hasn't discussed migration with the Trump administration. That's despite media briefings in Washington suggesting US diplomats will ramp up pressure on Canberra. Professor Gordon Flake from the Perth US Asia Centre says it's got nothing to do with Donald Trump's concern for foreign governments and everything to do with US domestic politics.
This is not them asking Australia and Canada and the UK to provide the US data. This is directing the US embassy to gather that data. Now, whether they'll be done in a rigorous way or an accurate way, obviously one has plenty of cause for doubt, because that's not what they're interested in. They're interested in fomenting fear, fomenting division, because that's something they ran on.
Gordon Flake says it's not unusual for foreign governments to report on these sorts of things. He says the problem is it's not really reporting. It's about creating a story to tell back in the US.
I don't think these people are particularly interested in data for data's sake. They're interested in the narrative.
Do you feel like this is impinging on Australia's sovereign, you know, capacity and sovereign rights?
Not really. This is the US State Department directing US embassies to gather data. If it was demanding the Australian government to gather and provide data, that would be a different story altogether, right? But, you know, the U.S. embassies, you know, they gather data on lots of things. That's part of what diplomatic posts do. I don't see anything yet at this point that I would consider to be an impingement on Australian sovereignty. But it is just one further example of what is at the core of this administration's approach.
Professor Gordon Flake from the Perth US Asia Centre, Julia Bergen with that report. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, the famous Outback pub featured in Crocodile Dundee has been sold. The Workplace Relations Tribunal, the Fair Work Commission, has handed down a landmark ruling ordering the energy company AGL to support workers set to lose their jobs when a gas-fired power station closes. The Torrens Island power plant in South Australia will shut down in 2028. Unions say it's a big win and sets a precedent for the treatment of workers losing their jobs as coal and gas-fired power plants close. Luke Radford prepared this report.
Renewables are now the most cost-competitive option globally for new electricity generation.
Net zero and the energy transition are topics that frequently spur furious debate in national parliament. But far from the halls of power in Canberra, workers and employers are preparing for the reality of what net zero will actually look like. For instance, what happens to those workers who run Australia's gas and coal-fired power stations?
I mean, I think the difference between this kind of closure and other kinds of closures, you know, that we have in our economy is that we know this is going to happen. We know that this is going to happen within the next couple of years. And, you know, with that knowledge, it's our duty to ensure that we're supporting the workers in this process.
That's David Shankey, the CEO of the Net Zero Economy Authority. The authority is an independent body that was set up by the Albanese government in 2024. Its main job is to support workers and communities affected by net zero. David Shankey explains what that looks like.
Well, they certainly need clear information about all the timelines and the next steps. They need career advice on what options they could have, and they need training options and financial assistance to do those particular training options too. So it's not a replacement here that we're talking about for existing redundancy arrangements, or this will sit alongside that.
In October, the authority put that to the test by applying to the Fair Work Commission for what's called a community of interest determination. It's a power that obligates the energy companies to support employees at closing coal or gas plants so they can transition to new employment. The target was AGL, who are preparing to close Torrens Island B, South Australia's largest power station, in mid-2028. The Fair Work Commission ruled in the authority's favour, although it's worth noting that AGL didn't oppose the application. David Shankey again.
So AGL, and I don't want to be too critical of what AGL had in place, but AGL had some voluntary activities that it was undertaking. And what this system sort of allows is that they now have to sort of sit down and make a formal agreement with their workers about what they will do and what they will put in place.
In support of its judgment, the Fair Work Commission cited that 70% of affected employees are over 45 years of age or have a tenure at Torrens Island of more than 10 years. The union movement says this is a significant result because it sets the precedent for future closures. In just the next 5 years, coal plants including Yallourn in Victoria, as well as Collie in WA, will shut down. John Adley is Secretary of the Communications, Electrical, Energy and Plumbing Union in SA.
A lot of workers will have transferable skills, but there is always retraining required because, you know, working in a power station is different to working on a construction site. So there may be some underlying skills that are transferable, but retraining is always required to some degree, particularly if an employee has been in a workplace for a long period of time.
John Adley says the union also appreciates that it's a fine balancing act for the energy companies.
The challenge in these type of transitions is always the tension between the requirement for AGL to keep the power station running until the very last day and retaining employees to do that. And, you know, the employees need to find other employment and where they find it, they need to leave.
So what happens next? Ella Waters is from the Australian Services Union, who are representing the workers in the negotiations with AGL.
So it means that the unions and AGL will have a few months to work out exactly what retraining, career advice and real pathways to new work look like, and will ensure that the workforce are supported as they are looking for new work over the next couple of years towards closure.
Torrens Island B is set to close in June 2028. AGL has been contacted for comment.
Luke Radford reporting. Well, when Paul Hogan's Crocodile Dundee film hit cinemas in 1986, one of the most famous scenes was set at the bar of the Walkabout Creek Hotel in northwest Queensland. Now the old-fashioned Outback pub has been sold to a new owner. Apart from being part of Aussie film history, the pub also plays an important role in the community of McKinlay. Maddie Nixon prepared this report.
Two beers, all right? One for me, one for me, mate.
For people all over the world, the Walkabout Creek pub is Crocodile Dundee's favourite drinking hole.
Here, Walt. Why Cyril for me while I dance with this charming young lady?
It's where, in the classic 1986 film, Mick Dundee burst through the door wrestling a crocodile that soon turned out to be stuffed and harmless. But for the locals in the tiny town of McKinlay, just over 200 kilometres from Mount Isa in northwest Queensland, it's the heart of a real-life community. More than a pub and the Bottle-O, it's also the caravan park and the post office. And Debbie and Frank Wust have been at the helm for a decade. Last year, they explained what makes the Walkabout Creek so important.
It's all that's left in town. The roadhouse is there, but it's unmanned. So if anyone wants to know anything, this is where they come. Most, if there's a fire, everyone rings us first. So RFDS, everything.
But now there's a fresh face behind the bar. McKinlay-born Angus Brodie has taken over the famous hotel.
That was where we'd always go in and meet up with everyone else. All the kids would get in there, and I have memories of running around, be able to sneak a packet of chips and the soft drink, which was a real treat, with all the other kids in there. And probably doesn't sound real good saying it on the radio, but we'd take our sleeping bags in and have a bit of a sleep over there until it was time to go home.
For Angus Brodie, owning a pub was more of a pipe dream than a reality.
Always been something as a little boy, you'd think, oh, it'd be pretty cool to own a pub, and never really thought too much of it until, the opportunity came up. Obviously, the pub is just the central hub of the McKinlay community. There's not much else at the township of McKinlay, but there's lots of families and, great community around.
But the Grazier and his wife, Jo Cranny, know just how important the pub is to the town. Wrangling cattle prepared Angus for a new learning experience, wrangling the beer taps.
Never poured a beer or done anything in hospitality as such before. And my first beer I poured, I think it was, half a glass of frothy head and didn't look real good, so I didn't serve that to a customer. And then the second beer I poured had absolutely no head on it, but I thought I might be right. I'd sneak it to the customer, and he went away for about 30 seconds and came back and asked if someone could fix his beer up. So I wasn't off to a real good start, but I promise, turn things around a bit now.
But for all its importance in the local community, this pub's place in Aussie film history is a big part of its character. Dean Law is a lecturer at Griffith University's Film School.
Those are iconically Australian images. We really fail to appreciate sometimes the power that just this one film had in implanting it around the world who we are and what our national identity is.
And it's an important part of Australia's entertainment history.
These things happen and they're not planned. When films like Crocodile Dundee or Mad Max or any of these early iconic Australian films were being made, that no one was trying to write history, no one was trying to create an Australian mythos, but they did. And we can either take ownership of that, and we can be deliberate about the fact that, just like the Sydney Opera House, this is a big part of our national identity.
Film fans will be happy to know they can still get a Crocodile Dundee fix at the pub.
Everyone's, still fascinated by the movie, and we've got the set bar out the back, and it's 40 years next year since the release of Crocodile Dundee, but still seems, relevant as ever. So call in, have a bite to eat, and a beer or a soft drink, and have a yarn.
Sorry about that, but I won't have anyone using bad language in front of a lady.
Bad language.
Good luck to Angus Brodie, the new owner of the Walkabout Creek Hotel, made famous in Crocodile Dundee. It's in McKinlay in northwest Queensland if you want to drop by. Maddie Nixon with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The devastating Optus outage that was linked to three deaths revealed we can't always trust we can get through when we call 000. More than 2 months later, surely the system has been fixed. Today, Consumer Affairs reporter Michael Atkin on why some people still can't get help when they need it most. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.